host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now! I don't hear any.
To the people of Kenya, who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede. And therefore, I will not sign.
Dramatic reversal. Kenyan President William Ruto says he will not sign a tax bill amidst a youth uprising and police crackdown that killed at least 23 people. Ruto called protesters treasonous. Now they're calling for his resignation as protests continue today. We'll get the latest. Then Gaza is the deadliest place on earth for journalists. A new collaborative project investigates the targeting of Palestinian journalists.
So many journalists have been killed trying to tell us what is happening over there. For the Gaza Project, we joined forces to make sure that there is no information blackout.
Direct threats, drone strikes, bombings of buildings.
This press vest was supposed to protect us, but now it harms us.
The Gaza Project will speak with one of the lead journalists who worked on the investigation, and will go to Gaza to speak with Palestinian reporter Shlouk Ella. Her husband, journalist Rashdi Siraj, head of Ayn Media, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October, then an attempted coup in Bolivia.
It fills us with bravery, courage to keep resisting, to keep on resisting any coup attempt, because Bolivia deserves its democracy, which has been won in the streets and with blood brothers and sisters.
We'll go to Cochabamba, Bolivia, to get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Kenyan President William Ruto has scrapped an unpopular tax bill following a mass nationwide uprising Tuesday when soldiers and police fired live rounds, rubber bullets, tear gas at thousands of protesters who stormed Kenya's parliament in Nairobi. At least 23 people were killed, dozens more injured. On Wednesday, President Ruto said he'd heard the message of the protesters and had reversed his support for the tax hikes.
The country witnessed widespread expression of dissatisfaction with the bill as passed, regrettably resulting in the loss of life, destruction of property, and disintegration of constitutional institutions.
Life very unfortunate, and sent condolences to the families of those killed. Earlier today, police and security forces fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at protesters in Nairobi after organizers called for fresh demonstrations to continue to demand Ruto's resignation. This is Lorna Diaz, a member of Kenya's Human Rights Commission. She spoke after President Ruto called protesters treasonous.
It's not protesters who are treasonous. It's Ruto's acts that are treasonous. There is nothing that justifies the use of live bullets on protesters. But this regime positions snipers to shoot and kill unarmed protesters.
We'll have the latest on the youth uprising in Kenya after headlines. Bolivia's president says he survived an attempted military coup Wednesday when Bolivia's former army chief deployed soldiers and tanks to government buildings, including the presidential palace in La Paz. In a dramatic showdown captured on live television, President Luis Arce directly confronted the rogue military commander, the dismissed army chief, General Juan José Zúñiga, demanding he stand down and withdraw his forces. After armored vehicles pulled back from the presidential palace, Arce addressed thousands of protesters who rallied against the attempted coup.
It fills us with bravery, courage to keep resisting, to keep on resisting any coup attempt, because Bolivia deserves its democracy, which has been won in the streets and with blood brothers and sisters. The people involved in the coup wanted to surprise us and the Bolivian people. We've reacted, and also the people have mobilized against this coup attempt. Thank you to the Bolivian people.
Hours after the failed coup, Bolivian authorities arrested General Zuniga, along with an alleged co-conspirator, Navy Chief Juan Arnez. As he was being arrested, Zuniga told reporters the apparent coup had been organized by Arce himself to boost his low approval ratings. President Arce, meanwhile, has sworn in new heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. We'll have more on the attempted coup in Bolivia later in the broadcast. Israeli warplanes and artillery fire have pummeled densely populated areas of Gaza City's Sabra and Shijaya neighborhoods in a surprise attack that forced tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee their homes while Israeli ground forces were seen advancing. Al Jazeera reports at least 8 people were killed, with many more missing and believed to be buried under rubble. In southern Gaza, there are reports of civilian deaths in Khan Yunis after Israel's military struck a school housing displaced people. Meanwhile, Reuters reports a Palestinian girl died of malnutrition in Kamal Adwan Hospital late Wednesday, becoming the 4th documented case of a child in Gaza dying of starvation or dehydration this week alone. The UN warns nearly all of Gaza's 2.3 million residents are going hungry, with a 500,000 facing catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity. The Israel Prison Service has significantly reduced food rations provided to Palestinian prisoners to the point of starvation, with many prisoners reportedly losing dozens of kilograms of body mass. That's according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which reports Israeli officials actively concealed information about Israel's failure to adequately feed prisoners as required by international law. In a letter to Israel's High Court of Justice, the far-right Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir argued in favor of cutting rations to prisoners, calling the policy a deterrence. Meanwhile, Israel's cabinet has advanced a bill that seeks to permanently ban the Al Jazeera media network from operating inside Israel. In Pakistan, doctors are warning of an epidemic of heat stroke as a searing summer heat wave continues to push temperatures as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit. In Karachi, home to some 15 million people, hospitals have treated thousands of heat stroke victims this week, with one charity reporting 450 people have died in the past 4 days alone of the heat. Residents say the heat wave has been made far worse by rolling blackouts as an aging electric grid fails to keep up with demand.
This is due to climate change that's happening all around the world. This is happening in Europe. They have faced intense heat, but they have taken steps to deal with it. But here it is sad that the government has not taken any effective measures. People are suffering from power outages by the power company that continue through midnight every day.
In the United States, the Supreme Court has rejected a lawsuit alleging the federal government overstepped its authority when it put pressure on social media companies to moderate misinformation around COVID-19 and the 2020 election. On Wednesday, justices ruled 6-3 that the plaintiffs, a pair of Republican attorneys general and several social media users, lacked standing to pursue the case, ruling there was no evidence the Biden administration's actions had caused them harm. Meanwhile, Bloomberg reports justices are poised to allow abortions in medical emergencies in Idaho. That's according to a draft copy of an opinion that was briefly posted on the Supreme Court's website, apparently by accident. If the 6-3 decision remains unchanged, it'll reinstate a lower court order that had ensured Idaho hospitals could perform emergency abortions to protect the health of pregnant people. This is known as the EMTALA case. The decision, however, does not resolve the core issues raised in the case. In a concurring opinion, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote, quote, "Today's decision is not a victory for pregnant patients in Idaho. It's delay. While this court dawdles and the country waits, pregnant people experiencing emergency medical conditions remain in a precarious position as their doctors are kept in the dark about what the law requires. The court had a chance to bring clarity and certainty to this tragic situation, and we have squandered it," she said. President Biden and former President Donald Trump are set to square off this evening in the first presidential debate of the 2024 election season. The event will be hosted by CNN. No other presidential candidates will be allowed to participate. The debate will feature no audience, and each candidate's microphone will be muted, except when it's their turn to speak. Tune into Democracy Now! Friday, when we bring you highlights of the debate and analysis. The state of Texas has carried out an execution for the second time this year. On Wednesday evening, officials at the Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville injected 41-year-old Ramiro Gonzalez with a lethal dose of the drug pentobarbital and pronounced him dead 24 minutes later. Ramiro Gonzalez had been on death row since his conviction for a 2001 rape and murder he committed when he was just 18 years old. The U.S. Surgeon General has declared gun violence a public health crisis. Dr. Vivek Murthy made the declaration in a video statement released Tuesday following years of pressure by gun control activists.
Gun violence has now become the leading cause of death among children and teens, and that wasn't true a decade ago or two decades ago. And so I'm issuing this advisory because I want people to understand the urgency of addressing gun violence, the importance of seeing it not as a political issue, but as a public health issue. And if we see it in that way, if we apply a public health approach to gun violence, we can do what we did with cigarettes and with car accident-related deaths, which is ultimately to make people safer, to reduce the toll on their health, and ultimately improve people's well-being.
The National Institutes of Health reports last year nearly 43,000 people died in the United States from gun-related injuries. A U.S. federal judge has sentenced former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez to 45 years in prison on drug trafficking charges. Prosecutors successfully argued Hernandez ruled Honduras as a narco state, as he accepted millions of dollars in bribes from cocaine traffickers in exchange for protection. Before his presidential term ended in 2022, Hernandez was a longtime U.S. ally who received unconditional backing during his eight-year rule, despite mounting reports of serious human rights violations and accusations of corruption and drug trafficking. And Brazil's Supreme Court decriminalized the possession of small amounts of cannabis for personal use. Although sales of marijuana remain illegal, advocates say decriminalization could slow the pace of mass incarceration in Brazil, where more than 200,000 people remain behind bars on drug charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Kenya, where police in the capital, Nairobi, have erected roadblocks and fired tear gas at protesters calling for President William Ruto to resign. Demonstrations are continuing even after Ruto made a dramatic reversal Wednesday and said he would not sign a tax bill that had prompted a nationwide uprising. This came after at least 23 people were killed and dozens more were injured Tuesday when police fired live rounds, rubber bullets, and tear gas at protesters who stormed Kenya's parliament. Ruto spoke in a televised address Wednesday.
The country witnessed widespread expression of dissatisfaction with the bill as passed, regrettably resulting in the loss of life, destruction of property, and disintegration of constitutional institutions.
In his address, Ruto called protests against his controversial finance bill treasonous. This is Lorna Diaz, a member of Kenya's Human Rights Commission.
It's not protesters who are treasonous. It's Ruto's acts that are treasonous. There is nothing that justifies the use of live bullets on protesters. But this regime positions snipers to shoot and kill unarmed protesters.
For more, we go to Nairobi, Kenya. We're joined on the phone by a Kenyan writer and activist who's asking to remain anonymous out of fear for her safety as the military patrols the streets. Thanks so much for joining us. I know this is very difficult for you. Can you explain what's happening? We reported yesterday on Kenya, more than 22 people dead. Then Ruto changes his mind, says he'll withdraw the tax bill, yet the protests are continuing. Talk about the danger you feel.
The show. What we're seeing today and has been happening for at least the last week is continued abductions of what are considered vocal protesters or organizers. It appears that the government is trying to get to the bottom of who was funding or organizing these protests without realizing that this is a youth-led and people-led movement. And that is part of the reason why a lot of us are online trying to call for the abductions to stop and abductees to be returned. We saw yesterday several high courts order the police to make sure that anyone that is arrested and detained cannot be held incommunicado under Article 49 of the Kenya Constitution. So this is one of the reasons why I'm speaking to you anonymously, just for fear of being abducted myself.
And what is happening, so far as you know, to the activists who have been detained and imprisoned? Is there a way for you to find out, especially after people have said that, according to Article 49, they can't be detained like this?
At this point, many of them not speaking outright about what happened to them. We know that this morning, for instance, an activist who had appeared on TV a few days ago was found in a forest, drugged, and has currently been taken to hospital for treatment. But what we're seeing on the streets right now is also just a heavy police presence. We've seen the deployment of the Kenya Defense Forces, which again has been deemed unconstitutional. The call for the Kenya Defense Forces to be deployed cannot happen without the approval of the National Assembly. So although we're seeing the president say in his remarks yesterday that adherence to the law and adherence to the Constitution, what we are seeing on the ground is much more different. And we're expecting a decision from the High Court regarding the deployment of the Kenya Defense Forces after the Law Society of Kenya sued the government for this decision that they made.
We'd also like to bring in a guest from Lusaka, Zambia, Mamka Anyona, an international finance and development expert who's from Kenya. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Mamka. If you could talk about the root causes of these protests and what exactly Kenya's debt situation is.
Yes, thank you so much, Namin, for bringing me to the show. And I salute my colleague who is speaking from the other side and braving the protests in Nairobi. So the march that lit this particular fire is the Finance Bill 2024, which you spoke about earlier, which the president declined to sign. This Finance Bill, the reason why this was such a match to an already sensitive situation is because the country has been in debt distress for quite a while now, and that has required the Bretton Woods institution, specifically the IMF, to step in. And the IMF stepping in has meant that there has been quite a bit of austerity measures over the last 2 years that have really brought to the knees an already weak economy. And when an economy is brought to the knees, the people who feel it the most are the young, the poor. So the levels of unemployment in Kenya are incredibly high. The levels of poverty are rising. The number of households that go without a meal a day are rising every day. And so the situation is really quite sensitive in terms of the economic outlook. So this new raft of taxes that were to be introduced in the finance bill felt like a step too far for a lot of Kenyans. And especially for young Kenyans who have gone to school and are sitting at home without jobs, they became incredibly engaged in the political process because of this particular situation. Now, the debt that the government is trying to deal with really is indeed quite a challenge. We have about $80 million worth of debt, and that keeps and the number keeps changing because our currency is also quite weak at this time, and it keeps and a lot of the debt we have is denominated in dollars.
You're talking 18 billion?
About $82 billion, yes, for an economy of about $110 million GDP per year. So this is almost 100% GDP that we have in debt to various institutions. Our greatest debtor at the moment is the World Bank, and with the IMF joining them, who have been lending quite heavily recently. You know, a lot of what we owe is now actually external, though there's also a substantial domestic debt that is held by a lot of bondholders. Over the last, I'd say 15 years, the leadership took out a lot of debt for infrastructure projects. We had a new railway that was funded through a loan from the Chinese Exim Bank. We have had roads, airports have been upgraded, but then we have to say that there has been a lot of mismanagement and misgovernance of these loans in the country, such that the infrastructure that we're getting is not at the cost that we should expect it to be. There's a lot of what we're calling budgeted corruption, where the cost of inputs is inflated, where there's a lot of mismanagement of funds, and this is something that is known. It is something that has been under discussion in the country for a long time, and so part of the reason why Kenyans are on the streets is not just because they don't understand that this is debt that needs to be paid. It is because a lot of the Kenyans were not consulted when this debt was being taken out. There wasn't the proper public participation that was necessary when this debt was being incurred. And Kenyans cannot see or they cannot feel the positive consequences of this debt and what it did in the country. And in fact, there are reports that some of this debt never even made it to the country due to corruption. We have our president, our former president, Uhuru Kenyatta, on record saying that we are losing at least $20 million a day to corruption. And this is the president himself who was saying this. So it's so the combination of, you know, of the distress that Kenyans are feeling, the situation that requires ever more tightening of the belts that is hurting Kenyans, and then Kenyans being very aware of the fact that the public finance is being mismanaged, and then obviously as was stated yesterday on the show as well, politicians living a very opulent life that does not match the sort of representation you would expect from in a country where people are suffering so much. It has all ended up creating this tinderbox that we're seeing.
I want to ask our guest, who is anonymous in Nairobi right now, the hashtag Ruto must go. Do you think these protests will continue to escalate unless the president is out? And can you talk about the allegations of corruption against him and his wife, among others?
Absolutely. I think I completely agree with my comrade from Lusaka around the fact that there's quite a bit of budgeted corruption. I mean, as much as we're talking about the finance bill, there is also the appropriations bill, which is a new conversation that young people are having online, which allocates hundreds of millions of shillings to the offices of the wife of the president and the vice president. And these are unelected and unconstitutional offices that our taxpayer money should not be going towards. And we've seen young people say that our taxes cannot be your wife's allowance, which just reflects the sort of frustration that we have around being told to tighten our belts. Meanwhile, we're seeing wives of officers of the state being awarded millions of shillings in taxpayer money. And the Ruto must go hashtag has come up as a new hashtag. Initially, today's protests were organized under Occupy Parliament. And we have seen an organic move towards Ruto must go, saying that it's not just enough to reject the finance bill, which the president in himself does not have the power to reject the finance bill. This has to go back to parliament, right? So the conversation that we're having is that there is a bigger issue beyond just the finance bill. And there is a big push to not only have fresh elections, but also have the parliament dissolved. Because what we have seen over the last 2 weeks is that we do not have a representative democracy. The members of parliament that we elected have said to us over and over again, we hear your voices, we do not care about your voices, we are going to do what we think is in the best interest of the president, not in the best interest of ordinary Kenyans. And so the movement to then find the political and civic education and the tools to then call for accountability as well as see the president leave office, I do not believe that that pressure is going to leave at any point. We've also seen already violence in the streets today. I saw reports of people already shot in various counties across the country. So we do expect that there might be more deaths today. And young people are saying, you cannot kill us all, right? So if even though you meet us with violence, we are still going to continue to insist that this country belongs to the people of Kenya and especially to the young people. A third of Kenya's 54 million population lives in poverty. 80% of our population is under the age of 35. And if we are not going to listen to the voice of young people, then we have no country at stake.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. Of course, we will continue to follow this story in Kenya. And I want to thank the writer and activist joining us from Nairobi, who asked to remain anonymous out of fear for her safety as the military patrols Nairobi, not to mention the rest of the country. And we want to thank Mamka Anyona, usually in Nairobi, but right now speaking to us from Lusaka, Kenya, a Kenyan international, Lusaka, Zambia. And she is an international finance and development expert. When we come back, the Gaza Project, a new collaboration involving 13 news organizations, investigates the targeting of Palestinian journalists. Stay with us. Oh. by Lina Mahmoud. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Gaza is the deadliest place on earth for journalists, by far. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, over 100 Palestinian journalists have been killed in Gaza since October. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate puts the figure even higher, at 140 journalists and media workers killed since the start of the war. According to the group, the deaths represent 10% of all journalists in Gaza. Now, a new collaborative investigation called the Gaza Project by the nonprofit group Forbidden Stories brings together 50 journalists from 13 different news organizations to investigate the targeting of journalists in Gaza and the West Bank.
According to the findings of the Gaza Project, at least 40 journalists and media workers in Gaza were killed while at home. At least 14 journalists were wearing press vests at the moment they were killed, injured, or allegedly targeted. At least 18 journalists were killed, injured, or allegedly targeted by drones, and six buildings housing media offices were completely or partially destroyed. For more, we're joined by Hoda Osman. She is the executive editor for Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, which was a partner organization in the Gaza Project. Hoda Osman is also the president of the Arab and Middle East Journalists Association. She's based in New York, but today is joining us from Amman, Jordan. We thank you so much for being with us. We know that there is a delay in this broadcast. Can you start off by talking about the scope of the project and your major findings, Hoda?
Thank you very much for having me here today to speak about this important project. We started talking about this months ago. It was a shock to all of us that the pure numbers, the scale of the killings of the journalists in Gaza was beyond any imagination. And by any standard, it's unprecedented. World War II, Vietnam, the Iraq War, nothing like this had ever happened to journalists before. It's a crisis not just for Palestinian journalists or Arab journalists, but it should be a crisis for journalists worldwide, the journalists community. And to be honest, we weren't seeing the outcry, the sort of the reaction that this crisis deserves. So I have to give credit to Forbidden Stories, the nonprofit based in Paris, whose mission is to complete stories for journalists who can't complete them either because they've been killed or censorship or detained. They brought us together to work on this project. As you mentioned, 50 journalists, 13 organizations. And in the beginning, when we started, really all we had was this like huge and tragic number, over 100 journalists killed. And we started from there. We wanted to investigate these killings. We started off by actually dividing the cases amongst us to look into every case and look into which investigations could come out of this project. And I can speak about some of the main findings, which included, I feel like maybe one of the main results is just like collectively by having worked on this for so many months and all of us together to sort of push back against the claim, the Israeli claim, that journalists have not been targeted, and to show through the different investigations that we've produced, I think over 20 articles and reports have been published by the different organizations, that there is a systematic attacks on journalists in Gaza and the West Bank too. We actually have two stories out of the West Bank, including a story about a specific attack on a TV crew in the West Bank. So collectively, just by looking at all the investigations together, you can clearly see that this is not just random, or the notion that because of the scale of the destruction and the war in Gaza, that this is just a natural result. And when you look at these investigations, you'll come to this conclusion. But also, I'm happy to speak about some of the specific findings and some of the specific stories that we've worked on, if you'd like me to.
Yes, Hoda, we would like you to speak about some of the specific stories. Maybe you could begin with the directed attacks against the AFP office, which you wrote about at length, and also explain how all of these different, because you have some of the leading media organizations.